Well, good evening. It's good to be here. After a day of travel, it's nice to sit still and see a lot of sort of strangers. But, you know, a stranger is a potential relationship, right? That's what a stranger is. But when Brother David contacted me some months ago to talk about this theme, I immediately replied, well, it sounds interesting. I'm sure you should find a wise person to talk about this. And since Brother David knows the scriptures, he was very quick on his reply. He just said, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And so I've been doing a lot of asking ever since that. Whether I have heard the answer is, I guess, to be determined yet, but oh my, I am blissfully unaware, because I don't have many ties to your congregation, I'm blissfully unaware of how your brotherhood relationships are thriving or not. I'm blissfully unaware of whether your marriages are flourishing or not, whether you're connecting with your sons and daughters well or not. And so that frees me to speak, and it frees you from the fear that anything I might say this weekend is particularly aimed at a particular problem you have in one of your homes or in the congregation. So with those things aside, I would like you for you to turn to James 3, and we're going to go right into the meat of things. I'm going to assume from the title that there would be a way to pursue our relationships unwisely, or without the wisdom that's from above, at least. Maybe some other kind of wisdom, or with none, perhaps. And the way that it's structured here, applying wisdom to our relationships, sounds like some kind of gear oil that we dump in over the works. And if that's the case, then it would seem that it would be tremendously important to have lots of it so that things don't squeak and become abrasive and so on. And we would want this wisdom that is from above to be liberally poured over all your relationships until the oil is running down, like maybe off the ears and beards, like in the Old Testament. The holy oil was anointing the priests and so on. But James 3:17, wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy, good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now, children are born to be social beings. That is, we come into the world wired for connection, wired for relationships. I read this astounding study that was done some time back, but I just read it recently, that twins in the womb, at as early as 14 weeks, have been verified through these studies they do that they interact socially at 14 weeks. Now, that's not very far along. But at 14 weeks, they can track how that twins have interaction with each other, like they're playing or something. They're made for relationship before birth, even. And we are that way. You watch little children; they come prepared for relationships, but not wise about them, right? They come, you know, the ancient philosophers thought that sometimes that man, the person born into the world, is what they called a tabula rasa, a blank slate. And then we write on there and we learn things as we go through life. We come unprogrammed. It's not like we come born into the world with an operating system optimized for relationships. We know how to do relationships. No, actually, we come into the world not very bright in some ways. Children don't know how to do a lot of things. They touch hot stoves, they chew on dirty band-aids, and they toddle into the path of oncoming cars, they claw the face of their friend, and they do all the things wrong and gradually they learn some wisdom. So experience alone is an avenue of wisdom. And you could say, well, is that the wisdom that comes from above? Just learning to kind of crash your way through life, and then, well, that hurts, so we don't do that anymore. Well, yes, that's the wisdom that comes from above. Where else would it come from? And so when a child learns early in school or something that if I act this way, I don't have friends, and he learns that and he stops doing that, that's the way God made him. That's wisdom from above too, just experience. But we're thinking about more things. So the wheels of life, the mills of life, you know, Gottes Mühlen mahlen langsam, the old German proverb says that the mills of God grind slowly, but they grind exceeding small. And life has a way of taking those abrasive edges off of us in relationships. Am I speaking for you? Is that how it is in life? Because pity the person whose sharp edges just don't wear down. Actually, pity the people around him, but this is how life is. And so when we're young, by default, we're a little short on that wisdom. And a fool is one who does not learn from his experiences. The proverb writer says you can put a fool in the mortar and pestle and grind him small and he will not learn. And yet James says here that if we lack wisdom, we can simply ask God in faith, and he will give it to us faster than by experience alone. It's like a shortcut. That's hard to imagine, that we could just say, God, I don't know how to deal with Sister Martha or whoever it is. I just clash with her or him, whatever. And so we could ask God for wisdom and get sort of like a shortcut to relational wisdom. That experience alone would have taken longer, maybe more bumps. Well, it's very popular these days to talk about relationships. You know, I thought about it as I was studying that there is almost no more dark indictment, especially of a church leader or a parent or something or a teacher, than to have it said of you, he just doesn't have a relationship with his boys. That's an evil thing. Ooh, we tremble at that. Or the ministry at that church is so out of touch with their members. They just don't have a relationship. And it's true that there are big trends over time in society and in the last generation here. Definitely, we like to talk about relationships. This is really popular because sometimes people do because they maybe feel they lacked foundational relationships in their youth. And so on. But I'd like to say that whether we're talking about the counseling or whatever world, that one of the first ways we should apply the wisdom from above is not be so careless with our terms and think a little more carefully about the nature of two human beings coming into contact with each other and saying things at each other. And spending time together, what is the nature of a relationship? So we're going to play school here a little bit. I want to draw some things out here. I think I would like to, even though that's very good. So let's imagine now, and I don't want you to feel that this is too psychological, but it is true that we have to learn how people get along with each other. In other words, I'm not putting this chart up here in contradistinction to what the scriptures has to say, but to try to understand what happens when two people meet. And I'm going to propose that for every person you have ever met and started a relationship with, however casual or light or lifelong or deep it is, you will progress through these stages. So the first stage, and I don't know what else to call this one. And I'm not going to write very big because I have quite a bit to write here. So the first stage, stage one, of when you first meet somebody, is you're trying to figure out if this person's going to hurt you or not. Is this person safe? That is the first thing you think. Now, just hang on. If you're thinking about a man and a woman's relationship romantically and how it goes on into courtship and marriage, that's tomorrow morning. But for right now, we're just saying when you meet a brand new person that you have never met before in town, at Walmart, wherever, and you meet them and something brings you together, I promise you that the first thing you are processing in your mind is this safe? And you, what do? You look at their eyes. You look at their body language. You listen to the tone of their voice. And in the initial stages there, we have customs in our culture. We don't circle each other and look at each other. We stick a hand out, right? And you shake a hand. What's that for? It's a good way to trade germs, right? Why is the custom of shaking hands? Where did that ever come from? Well, it's a way for two people to show that they have no weapon in their hand, and they're willing to touch, because that's kind of invasive, right? So we're going to touch, and I'm going to hold you a little bit. And at that point, we have sort of made an initial provisional pact that we are not going to fight. I have held your hand a little bit. That's what handshaking is for. In times past, other cultures, some have other types of cultures where they show both hands, you know, that I don't have a weapon, I'm going to be your friend. We touch. And you know the experience of meeting a new person and you're kind of nervous and going through the first few minutes and they have told you their name very clearly in the first 10 seconds. And 2 minutes later, when you've gotten through the initial interchange, you say, and what did you say your name was again? Why doesn't that stick? Because your mind is going 100 miles an hour right here. You're thinking about if this person, you're measuring this person. It's a measurement. Is this person, you know, what's up with them? What do they think of me? So you're thinking, what do they think of me? And you're measuring all that. Now, I know this sounds vicious. It's not. It just means you think about it. Is this person going to be safe or not? So stage one in your relationship includes that. And the conclusion is, when we get done with the actions, I won't write all the actions down. There could be other things you might do. But the conclusion is, we're always going to come to some conclusion at each stage. This is the first one. You will not hurt me. Okay? We decide that in our minds. And the threshold feeling that we have to pass before we can go to a deeper level is trust. That's what we call trust. You won't hurt me. You're okay. We get through those that initial time. Maybe it takes several meetings. It depends what the context is. But we have to get, first of all, to a level of trust. Now, admittedly, I could pick someone out here in the audience that I've never met before. I don't know your name. We could go through this little step. I could ask, you know, we could meet, and I could shake your hand, and I could decide if you like me or not initially. But there's already a lot of systems of trust in place here. You came into a Middle Mennonite church service. I see how you're dressed. I'm looking at body language, and you're probably okay. You know, I'm going to get done with this section right here with you in about 10 seconds after meeting you, or maybe sooner, in this context. But if you looked very different, and I met you in a dark alley in the backside of Cumberland somewhere at 2 o'clock in the morning, it would take me a long time to get through this, especially if you weren't saying anything and you had your face muffled or something. That could be different. Okay. But at some point, we get done with that in a relationship, and we're ready to move on to what I call discovery. And discovery, the next stage, after we decide that, you know, we're okay with each other, then your mind goes to the next step. Do I want to be a friend with this person? Well, I need to start finding out about you. What do you like? What interests you? What's your life like? What do you work? And we start looking for, Mennonites are good at this. See, who was your grandpa? You know, the game. What's that about? It's discovery. We're trying to figure out if we have common points. That's what we're after. That's how we build a relationship. Do we have common points? And then we discover, so do I. You know, I'm a tree trimmer too. That's neat. What? Tell me about your work. You know, men, they like to talk shop right away. Two men can be friends in a heartbeat, thicker than thieves, if they figure out they're both using the same kind of turbo in their diesel trucks or something. You know, the commonality can be fast, very fast, or, you know, it could be something else in a domestic sphere for women. I wasn't ready with an illustration there, and so the goal here is something like this. You like what I like. You like what I like, and I'm not going to say love. It's shallower than that. And the threshold feeling, if this relationship is going to go somewhere, is delight. Or joy. It's like, hey, I met John at the service station, and we got talking, and we just had a great time. And at the end of that stage somewhere, we were exchanging phone numbers, and we're going to come. I'm going to look him up again sometime, take him out for coffee. Because, why? He's safe, and he likes the same things I like. Well, we got relationships rolling now. That's going to go somewhere. Where does it go next? Let's say that you met this person, you like them, they like what you like, things are going along pretty swimmingly, and you're starting to spend more time. You know what the next stage is sharing. And by sharing, I don't mean talking. I mean giving stuff. Because one thing friends do when they start making connections, and they sort of, we really have a lot in common, they will start exchanging tokens of friendship. I give you something. I'll give you some stuff. I'll give you a gift. I'll take you out to eat. I will. We start exchanging things of value. We show that we like them. How do you show someone you like them? You give them a gift. It's a token of your love. Okay. So you share. I'm going to keep this a little weaker than love. Although you could write. You could write love in here, but I'm going to keep it a little bit more neutral. I meant to have that in the same. We're discovering things about that other person, so we'll say you. That's the result of starting to. We'll go with that. The threshold feeling, if my marker is going to hold out here, is affection or love. I don't know. I'm kind of making this up as I go. It doesn't sound that way. We'll go with love. We'll get it a little stronger. Where now we have exchanged and we start getting warm feelings. I really like spending time with John. He's great. Just really enjoying meeting him. Now, let's think about this. He's safe. We like things together. We've exchanged things because we like each other. But it's still not deep enough. What could be deeper than this? The fourth stage of a relationship is, I don't know. I had suffering. I'm going to call it dying. Because greater love hath no man than that he should give his life for his friend. So you could say dying or suffering. You would die for me. Or we could say you would suffer for me. And the threshold feeling that we understand out of that is maybe best explained in the Greek word agape, or agape love, and that is self-sacrificial love. So just to finish this out a little bit now, that's the lightest level of connection. I trust this person. The second stage is we have things in common. The third one is we like each other. The fourth thing is we have loved each other and shown each other our affection for long enough that we're special enough to each other that I would suffer for you. I would inconvenience myself and bend over backwards or die to save your life. That's a relationship that cannot go any deeper. That's it, right there. Now, this model I would like for us to sort of hold in our minds for this weekend, because brotherhood relationships, marriage, parents and children, they're all a little different, but they have this model sort of underlying this. And so, well, I might say on this last point, a special case of dying is one that we probably have not had experience in, and we may, but we haven't had experience with this. But soldiers do. I've been struck many times, I've read lots of military histories in my life, and men of the same company or troop who have faced death together, or have spent hours together in the face of death, and then one of their own is killed suddenly beside them, or they've gone through a campaign together, and they face death daily. They are so close that many times it's actually a problem for them when they come back home, because their own wives become envious. You're closer to those other men in your company than you are to me. And many times those men will say, yeah, that's right, but you'll never understand. You'll never understand what it's like to face death together. Or you read these stories, they're trained, you know. Remember reading, it was in Afghanistan or something, you know, some kind of grenade or something was rolled into the middle of their hole where they were, and the man, the one trooper, just threw his body over it in the second before it blew up and saved the rest of the men's life that were standing around him. I'm not going to lift that up because that's earthly warfare, but it is what Jesus meant. And it is a level of connection. That level of facing death for a friend is a level of connection of which there is no deeper. And if it's Christian, so much the better. If it's like Jesus suffering when we were yet unlovely, but we'll pick that up later. Okay. A couple of other comments about this model here. This helps explain why children establish friendships easily, because they are not wise. They cannot do step one. So they just make friends. And we teach our children, don't accept candy from the man in the Walmart parking lot, because the child doesn't know how to do a threat analysis. The child has to learn that. Step two, to exchange love, before love can be exchanged here. What is necessary for two people to discover things about each other? Maybe somebody should tell me. We're having a workshop here, right? Before I can discover something about you, what do you have to do?
Start offering information.
That's right. You have to expose yourself, right? You have to be willing to talk. You have to be willing to open your life. And so in order for a relationship to grow, there must be a dropping of the guard. See, when you meet, your guards are all up. And then as you learn to discover about each other, the guards fall down, and maybe it gets quite deep. You start confessing things. You start saying what your troubles are in life. And you start showing the unpleasant side of your life to your friends, because, well, before you weren't going to show him that, but now he seems safe. And so we start discovering, so there's a vulnerability, you know, no vulnerability, no love. You're never going to get here if you don't take the walls down. And this is very true in church. C.S. Lewis's famous paragraph was, love anything in your heart will certainly be wrung, possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping your heart intact, you must give it to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully around with hobbies and little luxuries and avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe and dark and airless, it will change. Your heart will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, and irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, that is heartbreak, the alternative to the possibility of heartbreak is damnation. Now that's heavy going, but it's 100% true. You have to open your heart to the possibility of heartbreak in order to experience love or any worthwhile relationships. So, now we're still pretty new here. I'm not ready to read to you out of my diary right here. I'm not ready to tell you about what my wife and I talked about last night. I'm not ready to tell you those things because we didn't go through these steps yet. But both parties have to, if you're going to have a relationship come together, there has to be an alignment of the fields of trust. I thought about an example. I didn't know these were made anymore, so I went out to a store and I looked for them. Anybody know what tricky dogs are? Oh, tricky dogs are wonderful. Almost couldn't get my sermons done for playing with them. But and you know, they're fun. You can't all see this, but you know, they're fun because if they're aligned right, everything works. If they're not, you know, they shoot all around and you can't get close. And what that is, what I'm using as an illustration here is that if there's someone you're trying to build a relationship with, you're not going to do it by yourself. You will not do it by yourself. The both parties have to align their fields of trust, or you will be playing tricky dogs with them. So that's maybe a step one, step two, somewhere in there. But it is true in church life. Now, one other thing I want to say is that sometimes we use the statement, well, he or she doesn't have a relationship. I'll say, no, our relationships are a little more subtle than that. Let's imagine some kinds of relationships I would have. I'm going to say that the gentleman on the front bench here with a gray shirt, I don't think I have any relationship with you. Don't know your name, really. Don't know who your family is. We've never talked. We've never, probably didn't shake hands. I've never given you a gift. I don't have any relationship with you, really. But we could. Maybe we should. Because I'd like to know what you like. But I don't have one. Because it's just not there. That's truly no relationship. Another kind, the second kind of relationship is what I would call a pending one. You know, you met somebody, 2 minutes, and he kind of got through a little bit of this, and then you separated again. You never saw them again. Do you have no relationship with that person? No, you do. You started one. You made a little overtures, and there's a little bit of a start there, but maybe it's parked. So it has to go on. And then if we get through these successfully, we could call it an amicable relationship, a friendly one. It's a relationship that's working. But if somewhere in one of these steps we hit the rocks, we don't think each other is safe, or we have positively nothing in common, or we do not feel like giving anything, somewhere in there, maybe some backstabbing happens, maybe something happens, and the relationship turns from possibly amicable to definitely hostile. So a hostile relationship is a full 5-star relationship. A hostile relationship is as much a relationship as an amicable one. And brothers and sisters, if you have ever known someone who's been gridlocked with conflict, you know that a hostile relationship is as hard to break as an amicable one. Because two sides are locked into each other and they can't even get apart. That's how a hostile relationship can be. And so a lot of times when we say someone doesn't have a relationship, they might really not, or they might have an adversarial one. They can be hard to break. They take God's love. We're going to have to skip over some parts of the lesson here. I'm just going to refer to David and Jonathan and talk about how two people can love the same things. I think David and Jonathan did. But David and Jonathan got to step three, didn't they? Jonathan said, "Here's my ring, here's my robe, here's my..." And it says the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. That's beautiful. And Jonathan had every incentive to compete with David, not share. I mean, here's a pretender to the throne. This is going to be my spot. He's taking it. He's getting all the attention. There was every reason for Jonathan to see David as a threat, but their souls were knit together. That's a tremendous story to study in depth there. It was primed for competition and hostility, but actually it was bathed in love to the dying moment. And then you have David's weeping in the Psalms. How beautiful! Jonathan, and even Saul. We can't go into that, but they were swifter than eagles. They were magnificent men. And he's bewailing the loss of those friendships. Well, let's go to some applications in brotherhood life here. Good relationships in the brotherhood are deepened by letting God's love flow through us to the others. And I thought about this. The servant that was pardoned his unpayable debt, the huge debt, and then he went out and he should have been just awestruck, like, "I just got freed from all of that obligation. I have just been pardoned." And he should have gone out and found that fellow servant that owed him $15 and said, and took him, Bible says, by the throat. He should have took him by the shoulders and shook him and said, "Do you know what just happened to me? I have been pardoned. I can't believe it. But don't worry about that little $15. You won't believe what happened to me." So think about that in the brotherhood here. Is that enough at this stage? If nothing else, much is in common between you and another man, you and another woman. You have not just very much in common, but you've both been pardoned. Is that enough to become good friends? Well, it should be. It should carry you. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute here, but it should carry you through and dispose you to love to that person, to suffer for that person, because after all, you've both been washed. Well, maybe it fits in here as well as anywhere. What if, at step two here, what if there's a sister, two sisters maybe, two brothers in the church, and, I mean, just not a lot of sparks are happening here at step two. I mean, what he wants to do when he has spare time is the last thing I would like to do. And so when we sit together, we don't know what to talk about. Maybe you're also perfectly aligned here at Life in Christ, that you share the same interests and hobbies and tastes and everything, and you just connect on every level. I've never been a part of a church like that. And so what do I do with my relationships in the brotherhood that I just have less in common with? I don't know. We just don't, you know. He, when he has spare time, he gets his spotting scope and he goes out to the bird watching sanctuaries and looks for a new kind of rare songbird. When I have spare time, maybe I put on funny clothes and go out with expensive sharp sticks and try to shoot turkeys and things like this. And we just don't connect. I mean, he, you know, we're just like, his world is just not like my world. And And so we make polite talk. We talk about how it's warmer than usual for this time of the year, and so on, and nonsense, you know, comfortable chatter. And it was pretty full at church this morning, wasn't it? Yeah. And we move on, right? After church, it's just, you just struck out. You just didn't have much to connect on. And then there's that brother, maybe, hopefully, there's a sister that you meet, and I'm telling you, you are never talking about, is it warmer than usual right now for April? No, because you have a connection to this person or this sister, and you go right to the things that matter to you both. That's a deep connection there. And that's important. Well, I'll just hold this thought up. We need to hurry on here because it's Saturday night. But Grace, one of the practical ways that this connection happens, whether we learn to form affections for each other or not, that's what I was going to say here, is that how many of you were raised in a congregation where you were at that same congregation pretty much for your childhood, 0 to 20? How many of you were in that stage? You went to a church somewhere for a whole childhood. Okay. You can think of families there, probably, that your family just didn't do much with, right? But probably, if you're middle-aged, you know, or older, you go back and meet some of those people you grew up with. Do you have something like affection for them anyway? Old times. Even if you went different paths, and even back then you weren't best of friends, but you had a common matrix out of which you were raised, and you had common experiences, and you listened to the same preachers, and you went sat in Sunday school together, and you did all these things together. You have some kind of affection with those people, whether you were best friends or not. That's always going to be real, and it grows. It's a blessing if you can go to the same church for years with the same people. It's harder than you think. It's harder than you think. I'm sometimes a little alarmed at how some of the more articulate voices in the Anabaptist community, the more articulate voices who write all the books and have all the good presentations, have trouble staying at one congregation. Have you ever noticed that? I'm not picking anybody out. I'm just saying that I've noticed this sometimes. And so what I'm saying is that to grow up at the same church and with the same group of people for 20 years is no small accomplishment. That takes a lot of relationships. It takes a lot of absorbing and a lot of grace. A lot of control of your tongue, maybe. Children, you remember the story about the crow that found a piece of cheese and went up in the tree, and the fox came along and saw the cheese in the crow's beak, and the fox started saying, "My, you're a magnificent bird. I wonder if your voice is as beautiful as your feathers." And then what happened, right, in the fable? The crow wants to reply or, you know, demonstrate, and drops the cheese, and the fox gets the cheese. And the point of that story is that what you do with your mouth is an unfakeable, an unmistakable window in your soul. We give too much credit to hypocrisy, I will say that. We think that you can be a hypocrite and you just plain can't. Because sooner or later in the course of your life, you reveal what's in here by the things that keep on happening here. It just keeps on coming out, and you show your brothers and sisters at church exactly what you're made of eventually. Well, maybe I'll just say this next point and we'll move on. But hostile relationships, if they happen in the congregation, that's really sad. That's a tragedy. And they're always rooted in the wreckage of selfishness or in the wreckage of sin or outright sin itself. Either by wreckage, I mean sometimes there's hostile relationships that maybe the person is not sure what's wrong, but it sure isn't working, and they don't know what to do about it. we can develop prickly side out, claws out, you know, just, yeah, it takes some cleansing there. And I have been close to people. I have seen families who have taken on the aggrieved personality, the injured personality in congregation after congregation where they have moved to. They have always been the victim of relationships, and they take that on as a persona, and they wear it, and everybody they meet can feel it in 10 minutes that I'm an injured person, and I don't trust people, and they're just not going to have friends, and it's going to take healing for people like that to start dropping the claws, to start receiving love. That's a tragedy when that happens. But truth must carry every stage of the relationship. I want you to read, we didn't read a lot of scripture yet, Ephesians 4 here yet. Ephesians 4. He says in here, in one of these verses here about speaking the truth in love, and my point here is that the truth has to carry all four stages of this relationship, because it is when we lie to each other, intentionally or unintentionally, that we make a lot of relationship wreckage. And by lying, I mean that's easier to do than you think. Lying is just when we show some false sides or we say false things. A friend, you know, one way to lie to your friends at church is to not tell them when they're doing wrong. That's how you lie to them. Because faithful, the Proverbs writer says, are the wounds of a friend. What does an enemy do? He stabs you when you turn around, knife in the back. What does a friend do? He tells you through your eyes, you are in trouble. You're doing wrong. Faithful are the wounds of, that hurts, by the way. But faithful are the wounds of a friend. It takes that. I remember I used to have a pastor years ago that loved to use the analogy of feet washing. And when he came and put his hand on my shoulder and said, brother, I want to wash your feet a little bit, I knew I was in for it. He was going to wash my feet. And then he would proceed to tell me where he thought I should change in my life. And you know, he had a gentle way of doing it, and I have a high opinion of him. To this day, I don't know if I was improved for it, but faithful were the wounds of that man because he had a loving way to do it. And that's speaking the truth. So the truth is, love and truth are not at odds. We don't say, well, I will make you feel better. I will make you feel more loved if I put my arm on your shoulder and don't tell you where I think you're really falling off the boat. That's not truth. And it's not love either. But a verse, I have a few things that I think are true here, and then we'll wrap this up here. So the truth is, verse 11, he gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and pastors and teachers. The truth is, there is diversity in the brotherhood, among the sisters, among the brothers. That is always going to be there. And how are you preparing your children to handle this diversity? By that we mean that some, yes, it's very practical. Some are better looking than others. Some get better grades in school than others. Some make more money than others. Some are better up front than others. Some are better at counseling and ministry and so forth than other people. And some make friends more easily, we think. It's not really true, but we think so. And so we get to looking at each other, and I am frankly amazed sometimes at how little of a thing it takes for that to hurt. My husband's name wasn't even nominated this year when we were choosing trustees. You know, it can be pretty low where the things that matter to us and well, he's always doing this or that, or look at his business now and he just bought two new trucks, and look at me, same dirty lunchbox. There's just these things are so real, and the diversity in the brotherhood is bearable when our parents, when you parents, teach your little people at 4 and 6 and 8 years old that no, you won't get what everyone else gets. That's not how life is ever. And I am frankly aghast. I will say this. I am aghast at how grade inflation is affecting our schools. It absolutely is. And it's out of a heart of compassion sometimes. We don't want Johnny to get an F. That would hurt Johnny's feelings, and we want everybody to be included. And I'm saying, wait a minute. If Johnny can't do that, and you don't tell him he can't do it, good for you, Johnny. Blue Ribbon Prize, you did pretty good. It was actually a 54, but we'll call it a 70 because that way you're not failing here. No, all you're doing is helping Johnny to not understand that in life he will be good at some things and not good at other things. And we have to be fair to our children and sit down with them when they're crying because they lost something or they do terrible at volleyball in school or whatever it is, and we say, that's just fine, son. That's just fine. That's how life is. Because if you don't teach them that when they're this high, they will be this high someday, and they will be in tears in the brotherhood because they can't stand the diversity that's at church. Anyhow, what if I don't have any friends? Well, that hurts too. You might need to sit down and do some homework. What am I doing? As the proverb says, a man has one's friends must show himself friendly. What am I doing to reach out to anybody? I don't know. We don't have time to get into that. But the truth is, we are at different levels of maturity in the church. Age and maturity. And yes, it is your calling to sit in the pews and listen respectfully when that same brother goes off on that pet peeve again, on that pet theme in Sunday school and devotion time after time. He has this pet thing he always talks about, and the whole church knows when he gets started on it, it's not going to get over till it's over at the other end of 10 minutes, and he has to say that thing again. And you know what? That's just fine. We are at different levels of maturity, and it should take more than that to disturb us. Such were some of you, but you are washed, Paul said. So we can absorb some quirky people, you know, the stubborn school board chairman, whatever. We can absorb some of these things. We're at different levels of maturity. The truth is, we all have an old man to put to death. I die daily. I have to be gracious with the people in front of me. I remember a man that I used to work for, and he was a great man of God, Yeah, he was fairly peremptory on the job, and I remember there was another man we were working with who was, I don't think he was a Christian as I remember it, and he had worked with this brother for years too on the job, and he told me one time, he said, yeah, brother so-and-so, he's a great man of God, but sometimes the devil gets into him a little bit. And, well, he was my church brother, so I couldn't agree, but I knew what he meant. And what I'm saying is that we all have an old man to put off. The truth is, quarreling and competition comes more naturally than kindness sometimes. Be not hasty in your spirit to get angry. The truth is, we can all grow more and more into perfection. Look at verse 13. Till we all come in the unity of the faith, of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man. So the perfection is what we're after. And that's why I sometimes ache a little bit inside when I meet people who are on the run. And what I mean on the run is they're on the run from a church. They're running from some church. And one of the things that you sit in council with them and you hear them say, at that church, they were always picking on me. How many of you ever heard that? They were always picking on me at that church. I don't know. I think more often than not, when I have heard that and listened to the whole story, I've decided that maybe somebody at that church loved them. Maybe so. Maybe not, but maybe. The business of growing into the perfection of the saints feels awful lot like picking sometimes. That's just how brotherhood life is. Well, the perfecting of the saints is glorious, and we'll look at some more of that tomorrow. I would end with two contemporary challenges that I just think, I ask myself this question, where do I think our challenges in our churches, in our conference today, our types of churches on relationships issues? I have two. I think that one is that screen-mediated connections are sapping the life out of real deep brotherhood relationships. What I mean by this is that where we used to talk, we now send messages because it's more convenient. But sending a message with our phones is not the same connection as talking to a brother or a sister. It's just not the same. We think it is, but it's not. And it enervates it. It saps the life out of what a relationship should be, because what a real relationship, where a real relationship flourishes, is when there's vulnerability. You know why messages are so popular? Because you can't hit me back right now. I'm not vulnerable to you to hear your heavy breathing on the other end of the line, or look at your eyes when I said that. And so we hit the send button, and shoosh, and then we wait, and we look at the phone and see, are they reading it? What are they thinking? And so on. You know what you've just done? You've just carefully put distance between you and that other person to mediate this relationship through. And I'm telling you, we have not yet seen the price of that. We don't know what we're going to pay the piper for that. But that is changing our brotherhood relationships to where you might exchange thousands of messages with a brother at church and rarely sit down and talk with him for 20 minutes at a time. That's a challenge we need to think about. My last one is that I think I sense in our churches, this is a little more complicated, but let me flesh it out this way. I sense sometimes an over-eagerness to assume that change would help us. Let's change something about brotherhood life, how we do church. Change would be fresh. Change would be good. Probably the way we're doing it isn't the best way we could be doing it. And so there's an over-appetite for changing. And I understand that some of this is an understandable reaction to some affiliatory matrices that we came out of, where things were more rigid and brittle. And we've gone on. We said, well, there was never fresh air where I was before. Now, there's always fresh air, the possibility that if we would change the way we do brotherhood life, it would be better. Something different about our church services, our fellowship meals, our men's meetings, or something. Some kind of change would sure help our relationships, wouldn't it? And it's an elusive desire. It's an elusive search. We get influenced by seeing how well it works in other churches. Sometimes in the past generation, you know, we heard about denominational or church pride. Somebody thinks, well, I'm this conference or this fellowship, and I really feel good about it. I don't know. I've never connected with that. I think every person that I've met that seemed to have denominational pride or something was just simply immature or deluded, because the much more common experience is denominational self-loathing, where we know how to make fun of the group we're part of and the way our church does it. And we assume that the way this fellowship or this church does it has got to be better. They have better relationships. I recently this happened. So-and-so church, they have brothers' meetings at the coffee shop every Monday morning. And we just hardly ever get together, our men. And I say, well, that's nice, but you're not at that church. You don't know what that church is like. And so, you know, I think I would summarize it like this. To persist and survive in your congregation here at Life in Christ, you will have to do an awful lot of giving in to each other and just go to prayer meeting. Just carry in that no-name casserole to the next fellowship meal one more time and help clean up the mess and wash feet one more time and hold somebody else's little babies and help bury their dead and weep with them and laugh sometimes and all of the concrete connections that make up community life as a brotherhood, that is what you must flourish in. And it's so much harder than we think sometimes to do those ordinary things the way our church has done them for the last 50 years. We just keep doing it that way. And as you're doing it, you know what's happening? Your children are growing up and they think it's normal. They think it's normal. And because it's normal, they are people that have learned how to build relationships, and they can go out into life and serve and build new relationships in a way that really makes the church beautiful.